All right, good evening. We're gonna go through some text, and if there are questions of clarification, meaning there's something you don't understand, then feel free to ask. If there are larger questions, I'm going to save those to the end. Next Motzei Shabbat is Chag HaShavuot, and the core event of that, of course, is Matan Torah. It's interesting that theology is not something that Jews do a lot of, and it's certainly not something that they reflect on a lot in modernity. And so what turns out to be probably the most important event in Jewish history actually gets pretty short shrift in Jewish conversation and Jewish learning, and that is, of course, what happened at Sinai. So what we want to take a look at is the original core text, which reveals some very interesting things, and then move on from there. So let's take a look at Perek Yud-Tet of Shmot, Exodus 19. One of the most striking features of the narrative is its confusion, its obfuscation, meaning that it's not really clear what goes on. There seems to be a deliberate sensory overload on every level, as we see beginning in Pasuk Tet Zayin in verse 16 of chapter 19. Vayhi b'yom ha-shlishi, it was the third day, meaning to say the third day after they had separated from their wives, the men, and this was going to be the lead up to Revelation. When it was morning, biyota boker, vayi kolot ubrakim vanan kaved, right? There's a sound of light show, there's thunder, there's lightning, there's thick cloud on the mountain, right? Vayecharad, right? Everything is trembling. Alahar v'kol shofar, yecharad alahar, it's out of order there. The voice of the horn, very, very loud, chazak me'od, right? And the people are trembling who are in the camp. So there's a picture here of a kind of awesome event. Nothing's really happened yet. It's just a lot of smoke and mirrors going on. There's a kind of special effects, right? So Moshe gingerly trying to bring the people out of the camp in verse 17. Vayotze Moshe ta'am likrata Elohim, right, to meet God, which is not your ordinary business meeting. And they are standing betachti dahar, at the bottom of the mountain. And almost redundantly, the verse goes back in 18 and says, Bahar Sinai ashan kulo. It's completely in smoke, in fire, and the whole mountain is quaking. So we've already sort of been told this, now we're told this again, right? The horn is growling louder and louder in verse 19. We've also been told that. And suddenly the people have disappeared, right? Because the last two verses there, 19 and 20, is God speaking to Moshe and Moshe coming up to speak to God, right? So the overall effect of this cluster of verses is that there's been a great kind of conflagration and the people are kind of hanging around and Moshe's trying to cajole them into meeting God. And then cut forward, and they seem to be somewhere else or not on the scene in terms of those verses 19 and 20. And it's God calling Moshe to the top of the mountain and Moshe going up. Then the narrative splits like in a movie, right? So it turns away and we get the Aseret HaDibrot, we get the Ten Commandments. Then the camera cuts back to the scene that it resumes the exact same scene, right, in chapter 20, where in verse 15, it again tells us exactly the same thing, that everybody is there, an odd locution, ro'im et hakolot, they literally see the sounds, right, and the lightning, and the thunder, and the voice of the shofar, and the mountain is smoking, right, and we know all of this already, and the people are trembling, and we know all of that already. And now a new thing is introduced into the text, which is their deliberate hesitation and reticence to have anything to do with this project. So they say, Daber ata imanu, in verse 16 of chapter 20, they say to Moshe, Daber ata imanu, you speak with us. V'nishman will listen. V'al yadaber imanu Elohim. God certainly should not speak to us. Penamu, lest we will die. So they're freaked. Whatever's going on here, we have no sense that they really know what's going on here, but whatever's going on here, we don't want to have any part of. You be the intermediary. You talk to us. Whatever it is that God says to you. This will be crucial. To make the point more emphatic, we're told in verse 18 of chapter 20, V'yamot ha'amirachok, that the people stood far off. U'moshe nigash el arafel asher sham elokim. And Moshe drew near to this cloud or darkness that represented the divine. Okay. And then God says to Moshe, say to the B'nai Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. That's a very funny verse in the context, right? Tell them, they ran away. You've all seen how, like, I talked with you, right? Even though it doesn't seem like he talked with them at all. In fact, he talked with Moshe and not with them. So we're going to have to retrace our steps here. Now, a very, very interesting thing happens when you consider the sort of post-biblical reception of this story, right? In modernity, a good deal is made out of the phrase, God gave the Torah to the Jewish people at Mount Sinai. That's like a core phrase of Jewish education. It's something that's mouthed a lot, the better to make it seem like the project called Judaism is tenable. After all, if God gave the Jewish people the Torah, we're supposed to follow it, right? The medievals, however, specifically the Rambam and the Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, are very, very specific about the fact that this is in fact not what took place at all. That God did not give the Torah to the Jewish people. And the text is very plain about that. God gave the Torah to Moshe, and Moshe alone. The Jewish people may have been witnesses on the scene in some fuzzy way. They may have seen something going on, but they were not the receivers of that tradition. They were the post-receivers of that tradition. The ball was handed off to Moshe, and then Moshe, in his own good time, handed the ball off to them at some other point. And that's the most traditional of perspectives you could adopt. Right? Why then, in modernity, do we emphasize the notion of God giving the people the Torah? I suspect it has something to do with the fragmentation of Judaism in modernity. You got to make a stronger case. You maybe have to make a case where you're overreaching. So you say, we all got it, and therefore it's legit.
Well, we were all there.
Let's leave that to the side, because that has nothing to do with textual evidence.
But the Torah was given in stages, though.
Right. And now you're way, way, way ahead of yourself, okay? Let's take it in sequence, all right? Right now, all we have is the evidence of the text, which is that God gives the Torah to Moshe. So what I want to show you now is how moderns look at this in some ways and how medievals look at this. So if you look on the second page, let's look at outreach arguments, people who do Kiruv in the contemporary world. And let's see the claims that they make. And then we'll compare those claims to the claims that are made by Maimonides, for instance. So in an essay called Did God Speak at Sinai?, which is part of a segment of what's called the Discovery Seminar of Eshet Torah, the following is said in source number 2. Who did God give the Torah to at Mount Sinai? Most people say God gave the Torah to Moses. Correct answer, but not according to the Bible. Interesting. The Torah's claim is that the entire people heard God speak at Mount Sinai, experiencing national revelation. God did not just appear to Moses in a private rendezvous, he appeared to everyone. This claim is mentioned many times in the Torah. The Torah claims that the entire Jewish nation heard God speak at Sinai, an assertion that has been accepted as part of their nation's history for over 3,000 years. The Jewish claim of national revelation, as opposed to individual revelation, is the central defining event that makes Judaism different than every other religion in the world. Now, you could well understand why they would say such a thing. Because in modernity, with its marketplace of competing claims about what is true and what is false, and what you should give your allegiance to distinguish yourself from other religions, specifically Christianity and Islam, you would have to say something like, you know why we're different? Because the whole people got our stuff. Because in Christianity, obviously, the claim is made on a much more scaled down scope, right? That Jesus was crucified and resurrected, that the stone was pulled from the tomb, and that X amount of people may or may not have seen him, according to different accounts in the Gospels, walking on the road after he was dead. But clearly a very, very small, select group of people are privy to this kind of miracle of revelation. Islam, of course, is even more private, right? Because the Islamic claim is that the Prophet Muhammad is alone on the mountain when the archangel Gabriel recites the Quran to him. Quran, of course, meaning recitation, literally. Right? So there, it's really one person and one person only. So it's understandable that an outreach organization which would be attempting to promote the notion of national revelation would come and say, you know why we're different than them? We didn't just skulk around privately in corners and then hawk the book afterwards. You were all there, you all heard it, and so on. Let's see if that claim jives with how the medievals look at the text. This is a claim that is paralleled by another contemporary rabbi, Lawrence Kellerman, in his article, A Rational Approach to the Torah's Divine Origin. He writes in Source 3 the following. The beginnings of all ancient and modern religions have a common thread. One or two people have a revelation and persuade others to follow. Islamic texts tell us that Muhammad founded Islam following the first of many personal prophetic experiences. Christian writings reveal that Paul first met Jesus, converted to Christianity, which is kind of a misnomer at that point. You're not converting to anything, really. And spread the faith more than three decades after Jesus' faith. In fact, the beginnings of all world religions are equally unverifiable. Never does a large, clearly identifiable group of people experience prophecy and live to tell others about it. The one known exception to this rule is Judaism. The Torah claims that every Jewish man, woman, and child alive in 1312 BCE, about 3 million people, according to the Torah, heard God speak at Mount Sinai and survived to teach their descendants about the event. Okay. So there's a very clear claim in both of these essays that this is a kind of national revelation. And the implication, if you don't parse the words too carefully, is that God spoke and the people got content, right? They got something that they were able to pass on to the next generation, right? Now, there are some difficulties with this interpretation from the text alone. Obviously, the pasuk v'yamod merachok enters into the conversation, right? Rashi on Exodus 20, and a Rashi that's very, very well known to many people. They stood from afar. They were drawing backwards 12 meal. They went a long, long way back from the mountain, as far as the length of their camp. And then this lovely midrash that the angels came and kind of assisted them back, kind of took them by the hand and said, you know, come back now, kind of thing. It's really when you get to the Ramban and the Rambam that things grow very, very interesting. And it's fascinating that they are unflinching in their desire simply to say, no, it's Moshe and only Moshe. And they do not feel some kind of theological imperative to say it otherwise. They just say it as it is. So the Ramban on the Pasuk there in verse 19 of chapter 19 in source 5 says, Moses went up near the head of the mountain where the glory was, in a place designated for himself, and he spoke with Israel, teaching them what to do. The Israelites heard the voice of God answering Moses and commanding him, but they did not understand what God said to Moshe. Ah, so now the plot really thickens. Because if we go back to Rabbis Cooper Smith, Zeldman, and Kellerman, we sort of have to rethink what they're saying. When they say the entire Jewish nation heard God speak at Sinai, that's a comment that's both true and false at the same time. Right? If we're talking about just a pure auditory experience, like people are there and they hear a kind of rumble or a noise, then it's true. But if we talk about it as a really meaningful communicative experience, then it's actually slippery in a false kind of way. I'll analogize. Let's say I'm in the room with two of you, and the two of you are speaking to one another, and I'm witness to this event. The only problem is that you're speaking to each other in a language that I do not understand and will never understand, right? I guess in the vernacular we would say Chinese or Greek. So it's true that I was there. It's true that I witnessed some kind of interaction. It's true that there was an auditory experience. But in essence, all I could attest to is that something happened. Now, one of you comes up to me after that conversation and says to me, I'm going to tell you what we were talking about. Here it is. And I accept it. But I accept it with no ability on my own, independently, to empirically verify what it was that the two of you were talking about. I'm simply there. I'm hearing or experiencing something happening. And then you come to me afterwards and say, this is what occurred. So it is in that sense that you have to think about sources 2 and 3 and 5, because they seem to be at odds with one another.
The difference is, in your example, he was listening to the two friends. You're not emotionally invested in what's taking place between those two people. But clearly, Pinedo had a severe emotional reaction, even if they couldn't understand what was going on.
What actually makes it even worse, really, for the traditional argument, because they're actually invested to remove themselves from the discussion. That's one problem. A second problem is that my analogy is false also, because the analogy is actually false at its root, the one I gave, because there's no comparison between me being on the scene and hearing two people talk, and the Israelites being on the scene and seeing Moshe have an experience of something, right? All they're getting is a lot of sound. That's why the verses make such a big deal about emphasizing the auditory visual experience, because that's what they're confronting, right? Now, I would argue that sources 2 and 3 actually lie in a very profound way, because the reader really believes when they read those sources, if they don't actually go back and read the medievals, that what's really going on at Sinai is what kids learn in grade 3, which is that God is speaking to everybody, like I'm speaking to you, and it's clear language that's plain and translatable, and that they got the Ten Commandments and the content, and they knew what was going on. But of course, the most charitable reading would reject all of that. So I don't believe that sources 2 and 3 are really just talking about an auditory experience. I think they're trying to lay one over on you, and to actually tell you that there was a kind of content-driven set of communications, which the medievals reject. The Ramban says it concisely. Maimonides, however, in source number 6, goes to town in the guide. So it's there we're going to turn to, book 2, chapter 33. This is one of the most striking passages of many passages in the Mor Nevuchim, published in 1190. It is clear to me, says Maimonides, that the gathering at Mount Sinai, not everything that reached Moses also reached all Israel. Speech was addressed to Moses alone. For this reason, in the whole Decalogue, all of the Ten Commandments, the second person singular is used. And Moshe went to the foot of the mount and communicated to the people what he heard. The text of the Torah, here he moves to the recap of Sinai that takes place in Parshat Va'etchanan, in chapter 5 of Deuteronomy, and quotes a verse from there. Moshe, stood between the Lord and you, the Jewish people at that time, to declare to you the word of the Lord. This is a very meaningful verse for Maimonides. He's trying to say, like, you didn't have a clue what was going on. I stepped in and I told you this is what the man said. It also says Moshe spoke and God answered him by a voice. And it is explicitly said in the Mechilta, which is a Midrashic collection on Shemot, that he repeated to them, meaning Moshe repeated to the Jewish people, each and every commandment as he heard it. Again, a text of the Torah reads that the people may hear when I speak with you. This is a proof, says Maimonides, that it was Moshe who was spoken to, and that they, the Israelites, heard the great voice, but not the articulations of speech. So he's very explicit about it. All they got was a bunch of noise. Only Moshe got language. Only Moshe got content. Only Moshe got meaning. His proof text is the following. The Torah says, you heard, meaning the Jewish people heard, the voice of words, but you saw no figure, only a voice. It does not say, says the Rambam, you heard the words. In other words, he is being medayik. He is distinguishing between hearing a voice of words and hearing words. Thus, he says, every time when they're hearing words is mentioned, it is they're hearing the voice, meaning a sound that is meant. Moses being the one who heard words and reported these words to the Jewish people. The sages also have a dictum formulated in several passages of the Midrashim and also figuring in the Talmud. There's a well-known Midrash They, the Jewish people, heard I, Anochi, which is the first of the Ten Commandments, and Lo Yiyeh, you shall not have other gods, the second of the Ten Commandments, from the mouth of Hashem. So now the plot thickens even more. We now have three scenarios. The first scenario was they just heard mumbo jumbo, right? The second scenario, which is the one implied by the rabbis and the outreach movement, is that they had clear communication and received meaningful speech. The Rambam, based on the Midrash, is offering an alteration of these, saying that they heard nothing, just noise, except for two things, the first two of the Ten Commandments. Now, for Maimonides, this is singularly important. Why is it, for Rambam, they would hear nothing but two, right? Now, the Midrash thinks about it sort of chronologically, historically, meaning they were on the scene for two, got totally freaked, and ran away, right? So the Midrash is thinking that they got the two because they couldn't handle anymore. But that's not how Maimonides reads the text. He reads it philosophically. They got two because two is the, those two are the ones that anyone can get at any time, no matter where you are. It's not Sinaitic, it's philosophical. This is how he interprets it. He says, the sages mean that these words reached them, the Jewish people, just as they reached Moses. And it was not Moses who communicated the first two of the ten to them. For these two principles, I mean the existence of God and his being one, are knowable by human speculation alone. It's not about experience. The reason they got those two is because being there was irrelevant to getting those two. You can get those two now in this room. With regard to everything that can be known by demonstration, the status of the prophet and that of everyone else is equal. You, I, and Moshe are equal in this respect because it's not something that's done through historical experience. It's done through philosophical demonstration. It's a mind game. There is no superiority of one over the other. So for the Rambam, it's a very deliberate staged project. God brings the Jewish people and Moshe together, creates this kind of cinematic operatic experience, which blows everybody's mind. The goal of it to be that the Jewish people should be witnesses, whatever that means, to this grand drama taking place somewhere else. It's like God and Moshe in the corner, smoke and lightning on the mountain. They're kind of witnessing Moshe emerging from the smoke, saying, look what I got, guys. I'm going to tell you about it, right? With the only side proviso that the first two are universal principles that all people can cognize on their own. Now, it's really a subject for another evening, this business of whether humans can actually cognize the first two on their own. This is part of his 12th century philosophical optimism, right, which has been blown up really in postmodernity, since Kant for sure, that you can just sit on a rock and figure all this out in your head, and it's provable by demonstration.
But you can't figure out that you shouldn't murder?
Sorry?
But you can't figure out that you shouldn't murder?
I mean, that's a whole other topic, but yes, you can figure out that you can't murder, right? And the Gemara says as much, right? but this is something totally different, right? There's no comparison between thinking of a moral sort of imperative not to kill and thinking where there is a divine existent and no others, right? So for Maimonides, the thing that you can prove by philosophical demonstration is these two. I was simply adding a parenthetical comment that even that optimism really doesn't stand the test of time. But in any case, his argument, the Ramban's argument, are very clear and very much different than the kinds of messages that people get today in their theological education. I speculated before, and it's just take it as speculation, that I think that the way it's taught now is an overreach that's born from insecurity, right? Because we are afraid that people will not cotton on to Judaism, So you need to make the largest possible claim for its truth in relationship to all of the other enticing things in the marketplace of modernity, right? So we have to say, you know, we're different and we're better and we're national and so on. The medievals, for whatever reason, did not feel the need to overreach in this way, probably because they had no, they weren't thinking that anybody is going to leave tomorrow anyway. The community was pretty much self-ensconced. They weren't going to run away like the Jews did at Sinai. So you could just tell it as you saw it. This is what the text says. And I don't expect that my telling you what the text says is going to make you go off the derech. So you have a very different set of principles going on between the moderns and the medievals here.
Do you really think if they heard it...
Who's the he here?
Am Yisrael, if they heard something, they obviously didn't understand it.
Right.
Whatever they heard.
Right.
Because the reality is, they spent 40 years in the desert, and it took them 40 years to learn it.
Okay.
So it doesn't really matter what they heard at the beginning.
Yeah.
They still had to be there 40 years. So
right.
That generation died off.
Okay.
To accept it to go into Israel.
Okay.
So they didn't. So it doesn't really matter what they heard. It wasn't that they didn't accept it. Otherwise, they would have made it into land earlier than they did.
My point is, I think, simpler, which is that you have to ask yourself whether this makes a difference that there was a national revelation or an individual one, right? Essentially, what emerges out of the story of Sinai is that the Jewish religion, as we know it, in its most traditional sense, is Mosaic. In other words, the one question a traditional Jew has to ask themselves is, do I believe firmly in the accuracy of Mosaic prophecy? Because I have absolutely nothing else to hang my hat on in terms of a truth claim. I'm not talking about the claim for religion that's functional, or what some call orthopraxy or social orthodoxy. There are many, many people who practice religion for all sorts of varieties of reasons. They like it, it makes them feel good, it's functional, it's continuous. I don't really care. I have no quarrel with anybody's raison d'etre for why they do religion. But this is talking about truth. And it's saying that the truth of Judaism comes down to one person and his experience at Sinai, and everybody else buying into not their own experience of content, but his experience of content. Right? I didn't say their own experience of anything, because they had an experience clearly of something. But when it comes to an experience of law or word communication or meaningful mitzvot, that's his experience. So you have to believe in his conveying of his experience to you, that it was accurate or that it was sanctioned. Sanctioned is probably a more important word than accurate, right? Because sanctioned means that whatever Moshe tells the Jewish people, whether he got it right or he got it wrong or he got it halfway, that God says it's fine, let's go with it. So we have to believe that God is saying, I'm going to tell you stuff, you're going to absorb it through whatever sort of prophetic means you have, you're going to communicate it on to the people, and we'll go with your version. And the Jews have to believe that the version that he's bringing them is somehow from the source, as it were.
What about what was written on the tablet?
What about them?
Were there words on the tablet?
And who got those words?
Well, they came down the first block and broke them.
Right, who broke them? Who has the text, right? Again, think of it like this. There's a fog. A man walks out of a fog with tablets. Where he got them from, how he got them, how it happened, right? You have this retrospective narrative. What's really interesting about the Torah, actually, is it's not actually trying to pull one on over anybody, right? The Torah could have written easily, right? I spoke to you and this is what I said to you. Right? It goes out of its way to say, no, that's not how it happened. It happened in a much more obscure way, and it's all about Moshe the prophet, who I assigned from the beginning of Shemot for this reason, right? To take you out of Mitzrayim, to bring you here, to do this thing. That's why he's here. That's his job. And your job is to follow him. So it's actually remarkable that it doesn't want to disguise this narrative whatsoever. It wants to tell you this is how the religion got off the ground.
But even in
Pirkei Avot, the Seder, right.
And it didn't bother anybody.
So the question is, I mean, it doesn't bother me, but I expect that it would bother a lot of people if you told them, no, you guys didn't get anything. He got it. You got it from him. Does that change? If it changes nothing for you, dandy. But for some people, it might change everything. Yeah.
You may have missed it, but when the Jewish people said, I will do what I will understand, after, what are they referring to?
Well, they're referring to, it's a good question, really. I mean, they're referring to the fact that law is being given, has been given, is about to be given, right? It's in process, right? It also depends on whether you believe that the Torah is now chronological or not.
That they didn't understand what was being said. Why is that statement there?
That statement is confirming it, right? It's a faith commitment. It's saying, you know, we'll do the stuff that you're giving to us, Moshe, right? And we'll work on it. Try to understand it, you know? It's always been a process of committing to the tradition and then working it out, right? What's very interesting about this is that, in other words, that's really how many people in traditional communities act today. They don't undergo a kind of, you know, philosophical symposium before they decide to accept the Torah. They're initiated into families that communicate to them the tradition, they absorb it and they pass it on. And the nishma part, right, sort of comes afterwards where you're going to try and understand what you do. My point here is that was the process from the beginning. It's from the beginning, they had faith in the notion that this person bringing them the content is the one to follow. Now, whether any of this is historically accurate, we don't know because it's a closed text, right? It's circular. There's no corroborating evidence outside of the text. But even inside the world of the text, that's the claim that's being made repeatedly. Yeah.
Are there any other commentators who, like, I don't know, I was taught stories about the mountain is held over our heads and we're hearing and seeing things?
Yeah.
Sure.
But, you know, the thing of it is that all of those stories are really, they're just fodder for interpretation, right? That you're talking about non-empirical, non-historical kinds of statements that are probably allegorical, you know, the sense of feeling compelled or feeling forced or having no choice or whatever that Gemara and Shabbat that you're quoting is giving expression to, right? You know, and there are other midrashim that talk about, you know, everybody was prophetic and everybody heard a voice and so on. I'm simply pointing out that in the sort of major medieval stream, there's a desire to engage the language on its face. They're not hearing content, they're hearing sound. So that was meaningful for Maimonides. Sound is sound, content is content. Also, I think because for Maimonides, not everybody is on the level. In other words, there's a kind of philosophical impossibility of hearing content. You're just not up to it. In other words, it would have to be Moshe. It couldn't be anybody else, because nobody else is going to be able to do the complex business of translating divine communication into human language. It must be him. The challenge for most people, if they even want to engage the challenge, which I assume most people don't, is whether that's too thin a thread to hang your faith on, which is it all comes down to, do you believe in the one God? You know, yeah.
Yeah, seem to be playing down, emphasizing Moshe, the fact that they experience this as a moment of revelation. And again, they are told to prepare. And on that particular day, remarkable things happen. It's not just a matter of sound. It's everything that's going on.
What things are happening?
Shofar.
Okay.
Where's that shofar?
No,
is it a rainy day?
I've stressed repeatedly that there's this awesome sort of sound and light show, and they're experiencing that. All I said was that you have to distinguish between that and anything which is a kind of model where somebody is I'm narrating to you things that I need you to know. You know, look, you don't have to talk about Sinai. Talk about your house, right? What is the best means by which you would like to tell something to somebody who's important to you? Is it this scenario? I don't think so. I think it's actually the opposite of this scenario. If there's the most important thing in your life that you've ever had to say to anyone, and you invited somebody over your house to say it to them, would you create thunder, lightning, smoke, sound, which people are running away from? Right? It's so obvious, it's staring us in the face, that this has nothing to do with God needing to give clear content that must be intelligibly understood by human beings. He just wants them to have a mind-blowing experience, not communication.
Right. He wants them to have a mind-blowing experience that they experience as the moment of revelation. They were told it was coming.
Right, but the question...
And it came, I understand what you're saying, assuming they didn't hear the content of Moshe, fine, so you have to work that out. But this is not just a matter of sound. I think you're...
What is it a matter of? What else are they getting besides an auditory visual experience?
Kolot.
Okay, so but it's just, again, what are they getting besides an auditory visual experience?
I think that's simplistic. Auditory.
You're using a lot of adjectives here, but you're not giving me a single argument.
Auditory, yes, it is visual. They are told something's going to happen, and it does happen. They lit a whole... The whole mountain.
Right, but it's not the Jewish claim that this was the revelation of Torah, right? Right, we call this Matan Torah, right? If you want to say that they had a revelation of sound and light, I'm with you. I don't disagree. In fact, it's perfectly explicit. But
I think you need to bridge, I go along with this, why it is that the content, okay, why they can't hear the content. It has to be Moshe, but this is not just sound and light. There may be sound and there may be light, and they are told this will be a moment of revelation, and it's out of the normal experience.
Okay, we're going to move on.
Okay.
When it comes to modernity, so revelation has to be re-understood, because in between comes revolutions of science and philosophy, and all the intellectual currents of modernity, foremost of which among are autonomy, right? People's reliance on their own sense of right and wrong and their own sense of what is intellectually coherent and what is fantasy. So in the modern age, it's interesting to see what Jews do to struggle with the account that comes from Sinai. So I'm going to give you a range of people, some of them, you know, traditional, some of them absolutely not traditional, to see what it is that people can do with it. So, interestingly, what Martin Buber does with it is he almost follows the thread of what's going on there, and he takes the conclusion that is non-traditional. Buber, in his book Eclipse of God in Source 7, says, "My own belief in revelation does not mean that I believe that finished statements about God were handed down from heaven to earth. Rather, it means that the human substance is melted by the spiritual fire which visits it. And there now breaks forth from it a word, a statement, which is human in meaning and form, human conception and human speech, yet witnesses to God who stimulated it and to his will," right? So that's a nice little heresy in there, right? Buber says, you know what I think happened at Sinai? They had this, like, incredible experience, no content. And afterwards, they began to assimilate it. And that assimilation of that experience became Torah, right? So it's almost like you meet somebody for the first time, and you fall in love that night. And it changes your world. Like, you're blasted from the inside out. So what do? You run home, and you start writing things down in your diary. This is what had happened, and this is what it felt like, and this is what it made me feel, and this is what I feel I must do because of this experience, right? So for Buber, the Torah is that diary, right? It's not a direct communication from heaven to earth. It's the human assimilation of that sort of mind-blowing experience that they have at a certain point in time that they write down. Now, obviously, Buber, clearly antinomian, non-traditional, etc., but not illogical. In other words, not illogical in the sense of taking that thread and moving it to its ultimate conclusion, which is that all you had is this feeling that God is in connection with you. So Buber actually stresses the fact that what's important about Sinai is that kind of experience. Right, that feeling of connection to the divine, right, to spirituality, to use a contemporary word, right. So that's one way of dealing with the implications from Sinai.
Did you say that according to the Rambam too, they heard the first two be brought? They are
no, they didn't. They didn't hear it in that way. I'm going to keep going. Here's a non-Orthodox rabbi who lives in Arizona in source number 8. Michael Wasserman says something very, very interesting in my view about how does a modern person who is autonomous think about this model. He says, "Today, to step back psychologically, to see and think from a position of autonomy is to make the self the arbiter of our reality, to compose our vision of the world. It is to own our truths, but to the extent that we own our truths, regardless of what they are, they no longer own us. as long as the self is judge and jury, its worldview is inherently provisional, forever subject to revision by the same mind that asserted it in the first place. If truths are claims that we can rest on, then our truths, to the extent that we are masters of them, are not truths at all. They are, in the end, words that we say to ourselves. The truths by which we orient ourselves must, by necessity, be larger than ourselves. The standards by which we judge our choices must be greater than our choices. When we yearn for purpose, for a sense that life points towards a greater goal, we're seeking answers that are not merely ours, answers larger than our own minds. Right? That's the modern predicament, right? That we trust ourselves, rely on ourselves, see ourselves as kind of the final veto for things. But in the very making of ourselves as the final veto, we enter into an area of distrust. How can I be the God that roars, right? It must be something bigger than me, right? Which goes back to the tradition of Avraham in the idol shop with his father breaking the idol. It's always been a question of how can we be the largest, right? So modern people are in a paradox. We value our autonomy. We accept authority and yet chafe at it. We're sort of ambivalent with authority. But to the extent that we accept our own selves as authority, we immediately run into a paradox, which is how can I be the authority of myself? So that's the problem. You know, in other words, what I'm trying to get us to think about here is, what would Sinai mean now? Like, what does authority mean for modern Jews, right? I'm not talking about the task authority that they may throw people in public. I'm speaking about privately. Do they feel commanded from the outside? Do they really feel like an outside voice kind of commands their life? Or is the bottom line that I really make the choices for myself, right? Okay, let's look at a few other modern looks at what revelation might mean for a modern Jew. So David Hartman, in source number 9, writes the following. Revelation in history is always fragmentary and incomplete. Revelation expresses God's willingness to meet man in his finitude, in his particular historical and social situation, and to speak to him in his own language. One cannot even automatically apply the revelation to later stages in the life of the community that received it. New human situations demand reinterpretation of the content of revelation. So, revelation, as I understand it, was not meant to be a source of absolute, eternal, and transcendent truth, but is God's speaking to man within the limited framework of human language and history. Today, it is much easier to encounter other persons of faith who disagree with us. There's nothing more efficacious for restoring humility to the human spirit than confronting people of dignity and conviction who disagree with you. Right? So Hartman giving a very sort of modern take on the idea that revelation is continuous, subject to continuous interpretation, and was never meant to be a set, fixed body of dogma. Now, that's not a new thought, right? That's a thought that has been sort of parroted throughout Jewish history. But the big question today is, who gets to choose? In other words, who minds the club of interpretation? Like, as I've said before in other lectures, like those old spy movies, when they knock and they, you know, slide the little wooden panel and they say, who are you? Do you get to come in and tell me what the Torah means or not? So in other words, it's a platitude to say that this is a text that's continuously interpreted. The big question now is, who is legitimately enfranchised to interpret it? That's the question of modern Judaism. Amos Oz once said, you know, it's not about who's a Jew, it's about who's a rabbi. And he's not far wrong, actually. So the question is whether Orthodox people are going to have humility on this point, right? That there might be other points of view. And somebody who is extremely good at articulating this a long time ago was Eliezer Berkowitz. He has a very, very interesting comment in his essay, Conversion and the Decline of the Oral Law, in source number 10. Berkowitz writes, "The Torah is from heaven, mina shamayim, so I believe. But I cannot help recognizing that the fact that I so believe does not make my belief a faith that is itself from heaven. The Torah is from heaven, but my faith that it is so is not. Neither is my interpretation of the meaning and consequences of that faith from heaven. If so, how can we deny conservative and reform rabbis and scholars the right to their interpretation? Of course, we Orthodox are the only Jews faithful to the demands of Torah. But no matter how much we insist on this, it will nevertheless remain our own subjective insistence. Could not then our non-Orthodox brothers and sisters turn to us and say with equal right that we do not represent Torah true Judaism and that only theirs is the true way? Pretty courageous stuff, actually, from a traditional thinker. And suggesting the fact that if it really is interpretive, in other words, if it was all open from the beginning, then it really is interpretive. Then it's actually much more open than we might suggest. And that when we close it off, we do it for reasons of convenience and expedience, right? Because the community has to have a set of frameworks to work within. But that the truth might be other, certainly intellectually, if not in the way we live. What does that leave us with? Right? It leaves us with, I think, a very private quest for each individual to decide what the truth of revelation is for them. Right? And I think that this transcends the rational. I think that there are many people who are intimidated by rationality. In other words, you enter the modern world and somebody says to you, you know, science doesn't support your view and history doesn't support your view and all these things don't support your view. But I think that faith is something that is good. I don't think it's a dirty word. It's not a four-letter word, at least not in English. And I think there's nothing wrong with saying that I have a belief system that isn't exactly congruent with the rational. And I think this was put really, really nicely by William James in Varieties of Religious Experience, where he says the following in Source 11. Rationality can challenge you for proofs and chop logic and put you down with words, but it'll fail to convince or convert you all the same if your dumb intuitions are opposed to its conclusions. If you have intuitions at all, they come from a deeper level of your nature than the loquacious level which rationalism inhabits. Your whole subconscious life, your impulses, your faiths, your needs have prepared the premises of which your consciousness now feels the weight of the result. And something in you absolutely knows that the result must be truer than any logic-chopping rationalistic talk, however clever that may contradict it. Everybody has this sort of sense. Right? It's not exactly able to articulate it. It may not make the best intellectual meal. But people who live a religious life do have this kind of core intuition, it may be very small, that there's something that transcends logic and rationality, that even though it may not all add up, that in the end, somehow, maybe it adds up for each individual person. Right? Okay. So I'm gonna close really soon. I'm just going to, like, I like to give extra reading in my source sheet, so you can go home and read. All right, so the next source from Tamar Ross, in an interview, talks about what the idea of continuous revelation would look like, right? That it is actually ongoing, and that her argument here is that this was understood by very, very traditional sources in Jewish literature, by Hasidic sources, and Kabbalistic sources, and so on, by Rav Kook, that revelation is fluid, it keeps happening, it's utterly dependent on human beings. In other words, I mean, Levinas once said this, that revelation is dependent on every human being because every human being is basically adding a piece to revelation. It's like an incomplete pie or puzzle, and everybody's got some pieces, and they stick the pieces in, and revelation becomes bigger and more complete, right? So, in other words, traditionally, many people think of revelation as a static historical event. There was this thing in a certain place and time where a certain lump of content got thrown down, taken, and passed forward. It turns out that in Judaism, that's probably not true. It turns out that instead of revelation being an event, it was a process. It was a process that was initiated in a certain place and time, and it's a process that continues ever forward. It's a process that everybody's involved in and requires sort of the collective communal consciousness of the Jewish people. So attempts to like nail it down to some kind of science inevitably fail. I commend you to Source 13. Here's an ad for Discovery, in which is highlighted in the second paragraph, hidden codes of the Torah, right? Hidden codes of the Torah, demonstrating the startling results of high-speed computer analysis of the letters of the Torah. So this is also interesting to me, because what it's doing is it's saying, again, I need to play on the turf of modern people. I need to interpret Torah in this scientific way. I got to do computer analysis of Torah codes. Because what William James was talking about, which is just trust your gut, is not sufficient. So we have to sort of start doing these things to try and add on to it. The problem is that once you do that, you're playing on somebody else's ground now, not playing on your native ground, right? So this is actually something that is put very nicely in Jay Michelson's piece in the foreword, and I'm going to stop here, in Source 14. You may remember Bible codes, Torah codes from their heyday. Using computers and a simple set of algorithms, enterprising researchers found that every 14th letter in, I don't know, the book of Habakkuk spelled out the name of this or that important rabbi, politician, or event. The data is cleverly mapped out on a matrix, impressing upon the reader the supernatural nature of the Bible. One reason that Bible codes have gone out of fashion is that mathematicians and statisticians have thoroughly, completely, and convincingly disproved them. For example, Barry Simon of the Caltech math department has shown that any sufficiently large text will have yielded similar little letter patterns in it. Famously, the same algorithms used in the Bible codes yielded similarly prophetic results when used on Hebrew translations of War and Peace. It's a true story. Indeed, when in 1997, popular author Michael Drosnin, who wrote a book on the subject, challenged critics to find the same prophecy regarding the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin in Moby Dick as Bible code folks had found in the Bible, Australian computer science Brendan McKay did just that. He found the same thing in Moby Dick. And for good measure, he found letter arrangements predicting the assassinations of Trotsky, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King.
Those were all divinely inspired works, obviously.
There you go. Excellent. In other words, the Bible codes are bunk. The fact that they persist, though, is interesting. First, it says something profound about the lengths to which proselytizers are willing to go in order to promote their religious views to other Jews. That is, they're willing to lie or somehow ignore the overwhelming evidence that contradicts their claims. And in this regard, it is noteworthy that Professor Simon is himself an Orthodox Jew, troubled by the spectacle of rabbis and missionaries conning prospective Balei Tshuva converts to Orthodoxy with pseudoscience. When faith uses science to justify itself, it undermines itself as well. Surely religious consciousness does not lie on the same axis as scientific proof. The enduring lessons of kindness, generosity, and holiness do not depend on astronomy. Would it not be wiser, following generations of philosophers, to differentiate between the zones of the scientific and the religious? Leave science to the scientists and reserve for the religious crucially important domains of the ethical and the spiritual. Faith, by its nature, is uncertain. Authentic religious consciousness is not a matter of absolutes decided once and forever with scientific certainty. Franz Rosenzweig once wrote that if the Sambatyon, the legendary river that stops flowing on the Sabbath, flowed through the German city of Frankfurt, of course everyone would be religious, but being religious would then be meaningless. There would be no choice, no agency involved. It seems, Rosenzweig wrote, that God desires only those who are free. Okay, further questions? Thanks very much.